The largest numbers of these immigrants were Irish and German. Critics of Jackson, himself the son of Irish immigrants, had blamed his election on the rising population of poor, newly enfranchised Irishmen. Everything in the shape of an Irishman was drummed to the polls, one newspaper editor wrote in 1828. By 1860, more than 1 in 8 Americans were born in Europe, including 1.6 million Irish and 1.2 million Germans, the majority of whom were Catholic. As the flood of immigrants swelled, the force of nativism gained strength, as did hostility toward Catholics, fueled by the animus of evangelical Protestants. In 1834, Lyman Beecher delivered a series of anti-Catholic lectures. The next year, Samuel F. B. Morse, a young man of many talents, best known as a painter, published a virulent treatise called Imminent Dangers to the Free Institutions of the United States Through Foreign Immigration. Urging the passage of a new immigration law, banning all foreign-born Americans from voting. Morse then ran for mayor of New York and lost. Meanwhile, he began devising a secret code of dots and dashes to be used on the telegraph machine he was designing. He believed there existed a Catholic plot to take over the United States. He believed that, to defeat such a plot, the U.S. government needed a secret cipher. Eventually, he decided that a better use of his code, not secret but public, would be to use it to communicate by a network of wires that he imagined would one day stretch across the entire continent. It wouldn't be long, he predicted in 1838, before the whole surface of this country would be channeled for those nerves which are to diffuse with the speed of thought a knowledge of all that is occurring throughout the land, making, in fact, one neighborhood of the whole country. Could a mere machine quiet the political tumult? In Philadelphia in 1844, riots between Catholics and Protestants left 20 Americans dead. The single biggest wave of immigration in the period came between 1845 and 1849, when Ireland endured a potato famine. 1 million people died and 1.5 million left, most for the United States, where they landed in eastern seaboard cities and settled there, having no money to pay their way to travel inland. Patrick Kennedy, the great-grandfather of the first Catholic to be elected President of the United States, left Ireland in 1849. They lived in all Irish neighborhoods, generally in tenements, and worked for abysmal wages. New York lawyer George Templeton Strong, writing in his diary, lamented their foreignness. Our Celtic fellow citizens are almost as remote from us in temperament and constitution as the Chinese. The Irish, keen to preserve their religion and their communities, built Catholic churches and parochial schools and mutual aid societies. They also turned to the Democratic Party to defend those institutions. By 1850, 1 in every 4 people in Boston was Irish. Signs at shops began to read, "No Irish need apply." Germans who came to the United States in greater numbers than the Irish suffered considerably less prejudice. They usually arrived less destitute and could afford to move inland and become farmers. They tended to settle in the Mississippi or Ohio valleys, where they bought land from earlier German settlers and sent their children to German schools and German churches. The insularity of both Irish and German communities contributed to a growing movement to establish tax-supported public elementary schools, known as common schools, meant to provide a common academic and civic education to all classes of Americans. Like the extension of suffrage to all white men, this element of the American experiment propelled the United States ahead of European nations. Much of the movement's strength came from the fervor of revivalists. They hoped that these new schools would assimilate a diverse population of native-born and foreign-born citizens by introducing them to the traditions of American culture and government so that boys once men would vote wisely and girls once women would raise virtuous children. "It is our duty to make men moral," read one popular teacher's manual published in 1830. Other advocates hoped that a shared education would diminish partisanship. Whatever the motives of its advocates, the common school movement emerged out of and nurtured a strong civic culture. Yet for all the abiding democratic idealism of the common school movement, it was animated as well by nativism. One New York State Assemblyman warned, "We must decompose and cleanse the impurities which rush into our midst. There is but one rectifying agent, one infallible filter, the school." And critics suggested that common schools, vaunted as moral education, provided instead instruction in regimentation. Common schools emphasized industry working by the clock. This curriculum led working men to voice doubts about the purpose of such an education, with Mechanics magazine asking in 1834, "What is the education of a common school? Is there a syllable of science taught in one beyond the rudiments of mathematics?" No. Black children were excluded from common schools, leading one Philadelphia woman to point out the hypocrisy of defenders of slavery, who based their argument on the ignorance of Americans of African descent. "Conscious of the unequal advantages enjoyed by our children, we feel indignant against those who are continually vituperating us for the ignorance and degradation of our people." Free black families supported their own schools, like the African Free School in New York, which by the 1820s had more than 600 students. In other cities, black families fought for integration of the common schools, and won. In 1855, the Massachusetts legislature, urged on by Charles Sumner, made integration mandatory. This occasioned an outcry. The New York Herald warned, "The North is to be Africanized. Amalgamation has commenced. New England heads the column. God save the Commonwealth of Massachusetts." No other states followed. Instead, many specifically passed laws making integration illegal. With free schools, literacy spread and the number of newspapers rose, a change that was tied to the rise of a new party system. Parties come and go, but a party system, a stable pair of parties, has characterized American politics since the ratification debates. In American history, the change from one party system to another has nearly always been associated with a revolution in communications that allows the people to shake loose of the control of parties. In the 1790s, during the rise of the first party system, which pitted Federalists against Republicans, the number of newspapers had swelled. During the shift to the second party system, which beginning in 1833 pitted Democrats against the newly founded Whig Party, not only did the number of newspapers rise, but their prices plummeted. The newspapers of the first party system, which were also known as commercial advertisers, had consisted chiefly of partisan commentary and ads, and generally sold for 6 cents an issue. The new papers cost only 1 cent and were far more widely read. The rise of the so-called penny press also marked the beginning of the triumph of facts over opinion in American journalism, mainly because the penny press aimed at a different, broader, and less exclusively partisan audience. The New York Sun appeared in 1833. "It shines for all," was its common man motto. "The object of this paper is to lay before the public at a price within the means of everyone all the news of the day," it boasted. It dispensed with subscriptions and instead was circulated at newsstands, where it was sold for cash to anyone who had a ready penny. Its front page was filled not with advertising, but with news. The penny press was a free press, as James Gordon Bennett of the New York Herald put it, because it wasn't beholden to parties. Bennett, born in Scotland, had emigrated to the United States after reading Benjamin Franklin's autobiography. "Since the paper was sold at newsstands rather than mailed to subscribers," he explained, "its editors and writers were entirely ignorant who are its readers and who are not. They couldn't favor their readers' politics because they didn't know them." "We shall support no party," Bennett insisted. "We shall endeavor to record facts." During the days of the penny press, Tocqueville observed that Americans had a decided preference for weighing the facts of a matter themselves. "They mistrust systems, they adhere closely to facts, and study facts with their own senses. As they do not easily defer to the mere name of any fellow man, they are never inclined to rest upon any man's authority, but on the contrary, they are unremitting in their efforts to find out the weaker points of their neighbor's doctrine." The people wished to decide not only how to vote, but about what's true and what's not. 3. If Thomas Jefferson rode to the White House on the shoulders of slaves, Andrew Jackson rode to the White House in the arms of the people. By the people, Jackson meant the newly enfranchised working man, the farmer and the factory worker, the reader of newspapers. In office, he pursued a policy of continental expansion, dismantled the National Bank, and narrowly averted a constitutional crisis over the question of slavery. He also extended the powers of the presidency. "Though we live under the form of a republic," Justice Joseph Story said, "we are in fact under the absolute rule of a single man." Jackson vetoed laws passed by Congress, becoming the first president to assume this power. At one point, he dismissed his entire cabinet. "The man we have made our president has made himself our despot. In the Constitution now lies a heap of ruins at his feet." declared a senator from Rhode Island. When the way to his object lies through the Constitution has not the strength of a cobweb to restrain him from breaking through it. His critics dubbed him King Andrew. Jackson's first campaign involved implementing the policy of Indian removal, forcibly moving natives east of the Mississippi River to lands to the west. This policy applied only to the south. There were Indian communities in the north, the Mashpees in Massachusetts, for instance, but their numbers were small. James Fenimore Cooper's The Last of the Mohicans, 1826, was just one in a glut of romantic paeans to the vanishing Indian, the ghost of Indians past. We hear the rustling of their footsteps like that of the withered leaves of autumn, and they are gone forever, wrote Justice Story in 1828. Jackson directed his policy of Indian removal at the much bigger communities of native peoples of the southeast, the Cherokees, Chickasaws, Choctaws, Creeks, and Seminoles, who lived in homelands in Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Tennessee, Jackson's home state. To this campaign, Jackson brought considerable military experience. In 1814, he'd led a coalition of U.S. and Cherokee forces against the Creeks. After that war, the Creeks ceded more than 20 million acres of their land to the United States. In 1816 and 1817, Jackson then compelled his Cherokee allies to sign treaties, selling to the United States more than 3 million acres for about 20 cents an acre. When the Cherokees protested, Jackson reputedly said, "Look around and recollect what happened to our brothers, the Creeks." But the religious revival interfered with removal. In 1816, evangelicals from the American Board of Commissioners of Foreign Missions began attempting to convert the Cherokee, declaring a mission to make the whole tribe English in their language, civilized in their habits, and Christian in their religion, a mission that, if accomplished, would seem to defeat the logic of removal in the name of progress. Meanwhile, the Cherokee decided to proclaim their political equality and declare their independence as a nation. For centuries, Europeans had based their claims to lands in the New World on arguments that native peoples had no right to the land they inhabited, no sovereignty over it, because they had no religion, or because they had no government, or because they had no system of writing. The Cherokees, with deliberation and purpose, challenged each of these arguments. In 1823, when the federal government tried to get the Cherokees to agree to move, the Cherokee National Council replied, "It is the fixed and unalterable determination of this nation never again to cede one foot of land." A Cherokee man named Sequoia, who'd fought under Jackson during the Creek War, invented a written form of the Cherokee language, not an alphabet, but a syllabary, with one character for every syllable. In 1825, the Cherokee Nation began printing the Phoenix in both English and using the syllabary in Cherokee. In 1826, it established a national capital at New Echota, just outside of what's now Calhoun, Georgia. And in 1827, the National Council ratified a written constitution. South Carolina-born John C. Calhoun, Monroe's Secretary of War, pressed them. "You must be sensible that it will be impossible for you to remain for any length of time in your present situation within the limits of Georgia or any other state." To which the Cherokees replied, "We beg leave to observe and to remind you that the Cherokees are not foreigners, but original inhabitants of America, and that they now inhabit and stand on the soil of their own territory, and that they cannot recognize the sovereignty of any state within the limits of their territory." Jacksonians argued that in the march of progress, the Cherokees had been left behind, unimproved, but the Cherokees were determined to call that bluff by demonstrating each of their improvements. In 1825, Cherokee property consisted of 22,000 cattle, 7,600 horses, 4,600 pigs, 2,500 sheep, 725 looms, 2,488 spinning wheels, 172 wagons, 10,000 plows, 31 gristmills, 10 sawmills, 62 blacksmith shops, 8 cotton gins, 18 schools, 18 ferries, and 1,500 slaves. The writer, John Howard Payne, who lived with the Cherokees in the 1820s, explained, "When the Georgian asks, 'Shall savages infest our borders thus?' the Cherokee answers him, 'Do we not read? Have we not schools, churches, manufactures? Have we not laws, letters, a constitution? And do you call us savages?'" They might have prevailed. They had the law of nations on their side. But then, in 1828, gold was discovered on Cherokee land, just 50 miles from New Echota, a discovery that doomed the Cherokee cause. When Jackson took office in March 1829, He declared Indian removal one of his chief priorities and argued that the establishment of the Cherokee Nation violated Article 4, Section 3 of the U.S. Constitution. No new states shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state without that state's approval. Jackson's Indian Removal Act aroused the ire of reformers and revivalists. David Walker had argued that Indian removal was just another version of the colonizing trick. Catherine Beecher, disavowing public speaking but advocating letter writing, led an effort to submit a female petition opposing Indian removal to Congress. After considerable debate, the bill narrowly passed, the vote falling along sectional lines, New Englanders voting 28-9 against and Southerners 60-15 in favor. In the House, while in the Senate, New Englanders voted nearly uniformly against and Southerners unanimously in favor. The middle states were more divided, and yet the debate itself had raised for everyone broader questions about the nature of race, one senator from New Jersey inquiring, "Do the obligations of justice change with the color of the skin?" There remained the matter of the lawfulness of the act and the question of its enforcement. The Cherokees argued that the state of Georgia had no jurisdiction over them, and the case went to the Supreme Court. In Cherokee Nation versus Georgia, 1831, Chief Justice John Marshall said, "If courts were permitted to indulge their sympathies, a case better calculated to excite them can scarcely be imagined." In his opinion, Marshall fatefully defined the Cherokee as domestic, dependent nations, a new legal entity. Not states and not quite nations either. In another case the next year, Worcester versus Georgia, 1832, Marshall elaborated, "The Cherokee Nation, then, is a distinct community occupying its own territory, to which the laws of Georgia can have no force, and which the citizens of Georgia have no right to enter. The acts of Georgia are repugnant to the Constitution, laws, and treaties of the United States." In New England, Marshall's decision led tribes like the Penobscots and the Mashpees to press for their own independence. In 1833, the Mashpee people published An Indian's Appeal to the White Men of Massachusetts, arguing, "As our brethren, the white men of Massachusetts, have recently manifested much sympathy for the red men of the Cherokee Nation, we, the red men of the Mashpee tribe, consider it a favorable time to speak. We are not free. We wish to be so." Marshall's rulings in the Cherokee cases, which touched on the nature of title, inevitably occasioned a pained discussion about the European settlement of North America and the founding of the United States. In 1835, Edward Everett, a Massachusetts legislator who'd led the fight against Indian removal in Congress, balked at the hypocrisy of Northern writers and reformers. "Unless we deny altogether the rightfulness of settling the continent, unless we maintain that it was from the origin unjust and wrong to introduce the civilized race into America, and that the whole of what is now our happy and prosperous country ought to have been left, as it was found, the abode of barbarity and heathenism, I am not sure that any different result could have taken place." Jackson agreed, asking, "Would the people of Maine permit the Penobscot tribe to erect an independent government within their state?" In the end, Jackson decided to ignore the Supreme Court. "John Marshall has made his decision," he is rumored to have said. The rumor appears to have been a wild one. "Now let him enforce it." The leaders of a tiny minority of Cherokees signed a treaty ceding the land to Georgia and settling a deadline for removal at May 23, 1838. By the time the deadline came, only 2,000 Cherokees had left for the West. 16,000 more refused to leave their homes. U.S. Army General Winfield Scott, a fastidious career military man from Virginia, known as Old Fuss and Feathers, arrived to force the matter. He begged the Cherokee to move voluntarily. "I am an old warrior and have been present at many a scene of slaughter," he said, "but spare me, I beseech you, the horror of witnessing the destruction of the Cherokees." On the forced march 800 miles westward, and by Jefferson's imagining backward in time, one in four Cherokees died of starvation, exposure, or exhaustion on what came to be called the Trail of Tears. By the time it was over, the U.S. government had resettled 47,000 southeastern Indians to lands west of the Mississippi and acquired more than 100 million acres of land to the east. In 1839, in Indian Territory, or what is now Oklahoma, the Cherokee men who'd signed the treaty were murdered by unknown assassins. By then, Jackson's two terms in office had come to an end. But during the years he occupied the White House between 1829 and 1837, ignoring a decision made by the Supreme Court, had been neither the last nor the least of Andrew Jackson's assertions of presidential power. Especially fraught was Jackson's relationship with his first vice president, John C. Calhoun, Monroe's former Secretary of War, a fellow so stern and unyielding that one particularly shrewd observer dubbed him Cast Iron Man. Calhoun had served as John Quincy Adams' vice president, too, and his relationship with Jackson had been strained from the start. Matters worsened when Calhoun led South Carolina's attempt to nullify a tariff established by Congress. Like the struggle over Indian removal, the debate over the tariff stretched the limits of the powers of the Constitution to hold the states together. One night in 1832, at a formal dinner, Jackson and Calhoun battled the matter out over drinks. The president offered a toast. "To our federal union, it must be preserved." After Jackson sat down, Calhoun rose from his seat to offer his own toast. "The union, next to our liberty, the most dear. May we all remember that it can only be preserved by respecting the rights of the states." The much lesser political skills of former New York Governor Martin Van Buren, also at the dinner that night, were in evidence when he rose to give a third toast. "To mutual forbearance and reciprocal concession." Between Jackson and Calhoun, there would be no forbearance and very little concession. Although the tariff cut the duty on imports in half, it still worried Southerners, who argued that it put the interests of Northern manufacturers above Southern agriculturalists. The South provided two-thirds of American exports, almost entirely in the form of cotton, and consumed only one-tenth of its imports, leading its politicians to oppose the tariff by endorsing a position that came to be called free trade. To protest the tariff, Calhoun wrote a treatise on behalf of the South Carolina legislature, in which he developed a theory of constitutional interpretation, under which he argued that states had the right to declare federal laws null and void. Influenced by the Kentucky and Virginia resolves, drafted by Jefferson and Madison in 1798, and also by the Hartford Convention in 1812, in which northern states had threatened to secede from the Union over their opposition to the war with Britain, Calhoun argued that if a state were to decide that a law passed by Congress was unconstitutional, the Constitution would have to be amended. And if such an amendment were not ratified, if it didn't earn the necessary approval of three-quarters of the states, the objecting state would have the right to secede from the Union. The states had been sovereign before the Constitution was ever written or even thought of, Calhoun argued, and they remain sovereign. Calhoun also therefore argued against majority rule. Nullification is fundamentally anti-majoritarian. If states can secede, the majority does not rule. The nullification crisis was less a debate about the tariff than it was a debate about the limits of states' rights and about the question of slavery, an early augury of the Civil War to come. South Carolina had the largest percentage of slaves of any region in the country. Coming in the wake of David Walker's appeal and the challenge posed by the Cherokee Nation to the state of Georgia, nullification represented South Carolina's attempt to reject the power of the federal government to set laws it found unfavorable to its interests. Jackson responded with a proclamation in which he called Calhoun's theory of nullification a metaphysical subtlety and pursuit of an impracticable theory. Jackson's case amounted to this. The United States is a nation. It existed before the states. Its sovereignty is complete. The Constitution of the United States, Jackson argued, forms a government, not a league. In the end, Congress adopted a compromise tariff, and South Carolina accepted it. Nullification is dead, Jackson declared. But the war was far from over. The nullification crisis hardened the battle lines between the sectionalists and the nationalists, while Calhoun became the leader of the pro-slavery movement, declaring that slavery is indispensable to Republican government. Jackson's feud with Calhoun meant that he had not the least wish for him to continue as his vice president during a second term. Reluctant simply to drop Calhoun from the ticket for fear of political reprisal, Jackson cast about for a subtler means by which he could get rid of his cast-iron man. His eyes fell upon a new and short-lived political party, the Anti-Masons. In September of 1831, the Anti-Masons held the first presidential nominating convention in American history. Founded on the opposition to secret cabals, like Masons or political caucuses, the Anti-Masons had decided to borrow the idea of holding a gathering of delegates, like the constitutional conventions that had been held year after year in the states. Unfortunately, the man the anti-Masons chose as their nominee turned out to be a Mason. But the anti-Masons nominating convention left two legacies: the practice of granting to each state delegation a number of votes equal to the size of its delegation in the Electoral College, and the rule by which a nomination requires a three-quarters vote. 2 months after the anti-Masons met, yet another short-lived party, the National Republican Party, held a convention of its own, in which roll was called of states not in alphabetical order, but in geographical order, beginning with Maine and working down the coast, causing no small consternation among the gentlemen from Alabama. Henry Clay, asked by letter if he'd be willing to be nominated by the short-lived National Republicans, wrote back to say yes, but added that it was impossible for him to attend the convention in Baltimore without incurring the imputation of presumptuousness or indelicacy. Clay accepted the nomination and set a precedent that lasted until Franklin Delano Roosevelt. For more than a century, no nominee accepted the nomination in person, and Roosevelt only did it because he was trying to put the point across that he was promising to offer Americans a new deal. Still, the practice of nominating a presidential candidate at a national party convention might not have become an American political tradition if Jackson hadn't decided that the Democratic Party ought to hold one too, so that he could get rid of his disputatious vice president. Jackson and his advisors realized that if they left the nomination to the state legislatures, where Calhoun had a great deal of support, they'd be stuck with him again. Jackson therefore contrived to have the New Hampshire legislature call for a national convention and to nominate Jackson as president and his pliable former Secretary of State, New York Governor Martin Van Buren, as his running mate. The election of 1832 turned on the question of the national bank. Like the battles over Indian removal and the tariff, Jackson's battle with the bank tested the power of the presidency. The issue was long-standing. Because the Constitution barred states from printing money, banks chartered by state legislatures printed their own money, not legal tender, but bank notes, signed by bank presidents. 347 banks opened up in the United States between 1830 and 1837. They printed their own money, producing more than 1,200 different kinds of bills. Under this notoriously unstable arrangement, counterfeiting was rife, and so was swindling, especially by land banks set up to speculate on Western land. In 1816, Congress had chartered a second Bank of the United States to help the nation recover from the devastation of the war with England. In 1819, the Supreme Court had upheld the constitutionality of the bank. The Bank of the United States served as the depository of all federal money and handled its payments and revenues, including taxes. Nevertheless, it was a private bank, reporting to stockholders. Its economic influence was extraordinary. By 1830, its holdings of $35 million amounted to twice the annual expenses of the federal government. To its severest critics, the National Bank looked like an unelected fourth branch of the government. Jackson hated all banks. "I do not dislike your bank any more than all banks," he told the bank's president, Nicholas Biddle. Jackson believed that the Bank of the United States undermined the sovereignty of the people, defied their will, and like all banks, had a corrupting influence on the nation by allowing a few moneyed capitalists to use public revenue to enjoy the benefit of it to the exclusion of the many. In January 1832, with Jackson nearing the end of his term, Biddle submitted to Congress a request to renew the bank's charter, even though that charter wasn't due to expire until 1836. Congress obliged. Clay promised, "Should Jackson veto it, I'll veto him." But in July 1832, Jackson did veto the bank bill, delivering an 8,000-word message in which he made clear that he believed the president has the authority to decide on the constitutionality of laws passed by Congress. "It is maintained by the advocates of the bank that its constitutionality and all its features ought to be considered as settled by precedent and by the decision of the Supreme Court," Jackson said. "To this conclusion, I cannot assent." Biddle called Jackson's veto message a manifesto of anarchy, but the Senate proved unable to override the veto. "The bank war," said Edward Everett, "is nothing less than a war of numbers against property. Jackson, man of the people, king of numbers, won in a rout." 4. Jackson's bank veto unmoored the American economy. With the dissolution of the Bank of the United States, the stability it had provided, ballast in a ship's hull, floated away. Proponents of the National Bank had insisted on the need for federal regulation of paper currency. Jackson and his supporters, known as gold bugs, would have rather had no paper money at all. In 1832, $59 million in paper bills was in circulation. In 1836, $140 million. Without the National Bank's regulatory force, very little metal backed up this blizzard of paper. American banks holding only $10.5 million in gold. Both speculators and the president looked to the West. The wealth and strength of a country are its population, and the best part of the population are cultivators of the soil, Jackson said, echoing Jefferson. Fleeing worsening economic conditions in the East and seeking new opportunities, Americans moved west, alone and with families, on wagons and on trails, on canals and steamboats, to Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Alabama, Mississippi, Missouri, Louisiana, Arkansas, and Michigan. They homesteaded on farms. They built cabins out of rough-hewn logs. They started newspapers and argued about politics. They built towns and churches and schools. I invite you to go to the West and visit one of our log cabins and number its inmates, said one Indiana congressman. There you will find a strong, stout youth of 18 with his better half just commencing the first struggles of independent life. 30 years from that time, visit them again, and instead of two, you will find in that same family 22. This is what I call the American multiplication table. Still, slavery haunted every step of westward settlement. Elijah Lovejoy, born in Maine, settled in St. Louis, where he printed abolitionist tracts, the distribution of which was illegal in slave states, leading abolitionists to call for free speech against Southerners' demands for free trade. In 1836, pro-slavery rioters destroyed Lovejoy's press. Lovejoy moved across the river to the free state of Illinois, where he and his black typesetter, John Anderson, reopened their business with a new press. That press, too, was destroyed by a mob. And when a third press arrived, Lovejoy, who was armed, was shot in the chest and killed, a martyr to the cause of free speech. To survey land and supervise settlement, Congress chartered the General Land Office. Surveyors laid the land out in grids of 640 acres. These they divided into 160-acre lots as the smallest unit to be offered for sale. By 1832, during a boom in land sales, the office was receiving 40,000 patents a year. That minimum purchase was reduced to 40 acres. In 1835, Congress increased the number of clerks working at the land office from 17 to 88, yet still they could not keep up with the volume of paperwork. From the south, American settlers crossed the border into Mexico, which had won independence from Spain in 1821. Mexico had trouble managing its sprawling north. Much of the land between its populous south, including its capital, Mexico City, and its most distant territory, Alta California, was desert, and chiefly occupied by Apaches, Utes, and Yaqui Indians. As one Mexican governor said, "Our territory is enormous, and our government weak." As early as 1825, John Quincy Adams had instructed the American minister to Mexico to try to negotiate a new boundary. The Mexican government needed the money, but it wouldn't sell its own land. As its minister, Manuel de Miari Tiran, argued, Mexico, imitating the conduct of France and Spain, might alienate or cede unproductive lands in Africa or Asia, but how can it be expected to cut itself off from its own soil? Mexico wouldn't sell its own land, but the Mexican territories of Coahuila and Texas along the Gulf of Mexico and west of the state of Louisiana proved particularly attractive to American settlers in search of new lands for planting cotton. If we do not take the present opportunity to people Texas, one Mexican official warned, day by day the strength of the United States will grow until it will annex Texas, Coahuila, Saltillo, and Nuevo León. At the time, Texas included much of what later became Kansas, Colorado, Wyoming, New Mexico, and Oklahoma. In 1835, Americans in Texas rebelled against Mexican rule, waging a war under the command of a political daredevil named Sam Houston. In 1836, Texas declared its independence, founding the Republic of Texas, with Houston as its president. Mexico's president, General Antonio López de Santa Anna, warned that if he were to discover that the U.S. government had been behind the Texas rebellion, he would march his army to Washington and place upon its capital the Mexican flag. When Houston sent a proposal to Congress requesting annexation, the measure failed for three reasons. First, Jackson feared annexation would provoke a war with Mexico, which did not recognize Texas's independence. Second, from the point of view of the United States, which, along with Great Britain and France, did recognize Texas's independence, Texas was a foreign country, which meant that its annexation was an altogether different issue than it had been in 1825, when John Quincy Adams, as Secretary of State, had sought to acquire the territory. Finally, if Texas were admitted to the Union, it would enter as a slave state. Quincy Adams, who, having lost the presidency, had become a member of the House, filibustered the annexation proposal for 3 weeks. The people of the United States, he said, dearly as they love the Union, would prefer its total dissolution to the annexation of Texas. The American Anti-Slavery Society flooded Congress with tens of thousands of abolitionist petitions. When Quincy Adams tried to get the petitions a hearing, Southern legislators silenced him under the terms of a gag rule that banned from the floor of Congress any discussion of anti-slavery petitions, another triumph for opponents of free speech. Southern slave owners, a tiny minority of Americans, amounting to about 1% of the population, deployed the rhetoric of states' rights and free trade, by which they meant trade free from federal government regulation, but in fact they desperately needed and relied on the power of the federal government to defend and extend the institution of slavery. The weakness of their position lay behind their efforts to silence dissent. Beginning in 1836, Ohio Democrat Thomas Morris introduced petitions denouncing slavery, calling for its abolition in the District of Columbia, and urging the overturning of a ban on sending abolitionist literature through the mail, only to have the petitions suppressed. Morris, uncouth and self-taught, had been raised by his Baptist preacher father to hate slavery. Early in 1838, he damned the putrid mass of prejudice which interest has created to keep the colored race in bondage. Later that year, he told an Ohio newspaper that he had always believed slavery to be wrong in principle, in practice, in every country, and in every condition of things. Unsurprisingly, he was not reelected. In February 1839, knowing that he would never again hold public office, he let loose, delivering the fiercest anti-slavery speech yet voiced on the Senate floor. Borrowing from the Jacksonian indictment of the money power, he coined the phrase slave power. Morris described the struggle as a battle between democracy and two united aristocracies, the aristocracy of the North, operating by the power of a corrupt banking system, and the aristocracy of the South, which operated by the power of the slave system. Morris closed by stating his faith that democracy would prevail and the Negro will yet be set free. The debate over Texas, along with the election of 1836, illustrated just how powerfully Andrew Jackson and John Quincy Adams shaped national politics long after the end of each of their presidencies. Jackson held the strings of the Democratic Party, while Quincy Adams steered the erratic course of the Whig Party. Jackson decided not to run for a third term, but just as he'd connived to rid himself of Calhoun in 1832, he was determined to choose his successor. Once again, King Andrew masqueraded as the champion of the common man. In 1835, Jackson issued a call for a Democratic nominating convention in an extraordinary letter published first in a Tennessee newspaper. I consider the true policy of the Friends of Republican Principles to send delegates fresh from the people to a general convention for the purpose of selecting candidates for the presidency and vice presidency, and that to impeach that selection before it is made, or to resist it when it is fairly made, as an emanation of executive power, is to assail the virtue of the people and, in effect, to oppose their right to govern. For all his flummery about the virtue of the people and their right to govern, the point of this convention was to assure the nomination of Jackson's hand-picked successor, Barton Van Buren, and to allow for Van Buren to contrive for his choice, Richard Johnson, to win the vice presidential nomination. The calumny did not go unnoticed. Tennessee, whose support for Jackson had long since begun to waver, refused to send a delegation to the convention held in Baltimore. Unwilling to forfeit Tennessee's 15 electoral votes at the convention, Van Buren's convention manager, New York Senator Silas Wright, went to a tavern and found a Tennessean who just happened to be in the city, Edward Rucker, who became a one-man, 15-vote delegation. Ruckerize became a verb. It means to commit political skullduggery by packing a convention. But Quincy Adams's party found itself in still greater disarray. Disorganized and dispersed, the Whigs failed to hold a nominating convention and could not decide on a single candidate. 4 different Whigs ran for president, splitting the party and leaving a wide path for the Democratic candidate Van Buren to ride to electoral victory. Van Buren took office in March of 1837. 5 weeks later, the nation's financial system fell apart in the worst financial disaster in American history, second only to the crash of 1929. "The stock market collapsed. The blackness of darkness still hangeth over it," one New Yorker wrote from Wall Street that April. By the fall of 1837, 9 out of 10 Eastern factories had closed. The poor broke into shops, only to find their shelves empty. What began with the Panic of 1837 ended after only a 7-year-long depression, well into a decade of despair, known as the Hungry Forties. Whigs dubbed the new president Martin Van Ruin, which was unfair, since the fall was the result of Jackson's decisions, not Van Buren's, the consequence, above all, of an unregulated banking industry. But if the suffering was Jacksonian, so was its relief. The Panic of 1837 democratized bankruptcy protection and led to the abolition of debtors' prisons. In 1810, a New York lawyer named Joseph Dewey Fay, who claimed to have spent 16 years in debtors' prison, had estimated in the aftermath of the Panic of 1809, 10% of New York's freemen had been arrested for debt. "Americans boast that they have done away with torture," Fay had written, "but the debtors' prison is torture." Fay had gone to Albany and successfully lobbied the legislature to pass an expanded insolvency law for imprisoned debtors. 2,500 debtors availed themselves of discharge in the law's first 9 months. Earlier bankruptcy laws had protected only stockbrokers, but the new law set a precedent. It was the first legislation anywhere to offer bankruptcy to everyone. In 1819, the Supreme Court had ruled it unconstitutional. Still, a turn had come. New York abolished debtors' prison in 1831, and in 1841, Congress passed a federal law offering bankruptcy protection to everyone. Within 2 years, 41,000 Americans had filed for bankruptcy. 2 years later, the law was repealed, but state laws continued to offer bankruptcy protection. And still more significantly, debtors' prisons were gone for good. In Britain and all of Europe except Portugal, offenders were still being thrown in debtors' prison, a plot that animated many a 19th-century novel. In the United States, debtors could declare bankruptcy and begin again. The forgiveness of debts fostered a spirit of risk-taking that fueled American enterprise. Tocqueville marveled at the strange indulgence which is shown to bankrupts in the United States. In this, he observed, "Americans differ not only from the nations of Europe, but from all the commercial nations of our time." A nation of debtors, Americans came to see that most people who fall into debt are victims of the business cycle, and not of fate, or divine retribution, or the wheel of fortune. The nation's bankruptcy laws, even as they came and went again, made taking risks less risky for everyone, which meant that everyone took more risks. Martin Van Ruin didn't stand much of a chance at re-election in 1840. Voters blamed both him and his party for the misery caused by Jackson. The Whigs, unsurprisingly, but in a move that would become characteristic of American campaigning, argued that the Democrats, the so-called Party of the People, had in fact failed the people. The Democratic Party, Whigs claimed, had become the party of tyranny and corruption, and the Whigs were the real people's party. "The Whigs are the Democrats, if there must be a party by that name," one Whig insisted. For their presidential candidate, the Whigs nominated 72-year-old William Henry Harrison, ran him as a war hero, and tried to pitch him as a Jacksonian man of the people, and even a frontiersman, which required considerable stretching of the truth. Harrison had served as governor of the Indiana Territory and as a senator from Ohio, but he came from eminent forebears. His father, a Virginia plantation owner, had signed the Declaration of Independence. Writing in 1839, Harrison's campaign biographer tried, in The People's Presidential Candidate, to present the staggeringly wealthy Harrison as a humble farmer who had never been rich. Harrison exerted himself, delivering at a hotel in Ohio the first ever presidential campaign speech, but his campaign urged him not to say too much. "Let him then rely entirely on the past," they advised. "Let him say not one single word about his principles or his creed. Let him say nothing. Promise nothing." Critics dubbed him General Mum. Democrats mocked Harrison by suggesting that, so poor as he was, he lived in a log cabin and drank nothing but hard cider. Wiggs took this as a political gift. Calling Harrison the log cabin candidate, they campaigned in log cabins mounted on wheels and hitched to horses, handing out mugs of hard cider along the road. Harrison, of course, lived in a mansion. But after the log cabin campaign of 1840, few presidential candidates, whether they started out poor or whether they started out rich, failed to run as log cabin candidates. Busy dueling for the mantle of Party of the People, neither the Whigs nor the Democrats offered a plausible solution to the problem of slavery. They barely addressed it. This led to the founding of new parties, including the Evangelical Liberty Party, formed in 1839. "We must abolish slavery," the party pledged, "and as sure as the sun rises, we shall in 5 or 6 years run over slavery at full gallop unless she pulls herself up and gets out of the way of Liberty's cavalry." Its bid to evangelical Whigs? Vote as you pray. The religious revival that had brought women into moral reform also carried them into politics. In the 1820s and 1830s, Jacksonian democracy involved a lot of brawls. When the reformer Fanny Wright tried to attend a convention in 1836, she was called a female man. But while Democrats banned women from their rallies, Whigs welcomed them. In the 1840s, as one contemporary observed, the ladies were Whigs. Beginning with the Whig Party, long before women could vote, they brought into the parties a political style they'd perfected first as abolitionists and then as prohibitionists, the moral crusade, pious and uncompromising. No election has been the same since. During the years that Democrats ran against Whigs, both parties incorporated both Jacksonian populism, the endless appeals to the people, and the spirit of evangelical reform. Campaign rallies borrowed their style and zeal from revival meetings. Walt Whitman complained about the never-ending audacity of elected persons, damning men in politics as members of the establishment, no matter their appeals to the people. But those appeals were hardly meaningless. Undeniably, the nature of American democracy had changed. Not only were more men able to vote, but more men did vote. Voter turnout rose from 27% in 1824 to 58% in 1838 and to 80% in 1840. Harrison won by a landslide. He then promptly died of pneumonia. His vice president and successor, John Tyler, came to be called his accidency, but the log cabin, like the female reformer, proved long-lived. So did the battle for the soul of the nation in an age of machines. "The United States is the country of the future," Ralph Waldo Emerson proclaimed in February 1844, rhapsodizing about a country of beginnings, of projects, of vast designs and expectations. That spring, Samuel F.B. Morse sat at a desk in the chambers of the U.S. Supreme Court and tapped out a message on his new telegraph machine, along wires stretched between Washington and Baltimore, paid for by Congress. His first message, in a code no longer secret, "What hath God wrought?" Meanwhile, a railroad line that began in Boston reached Emerson's hometown of Concord, Massachusetts. "I hear the whistle of the locomotive in the woods," Emerson wrote in his journal. "It is the voice of the civility of the 19th century saying, 'Here I am.'" The United States had been founded as a political experiment. It seemed natural that it should advance and grow through other kinds of experimentation. By December, telegraph wires would be installed along lines cut by train tracks through woods and meadows and even mountains, and Americans began imagining a future in which both the railroad and the telegraph would reach all the way across the continent. "The greatest revolution of modern times, and indeed of all time, for the amelioration of society, has been effected by the magnetic telegraph," the New York Sun announced, proclaiming the annihilation of space. Time was being annihilated, too. News spread in a flash. As penny press printer James Gordon Bennett of the New York Herald pointed out, the telegraph appeared to make it possible for the whole nation to have the same idea at the same time. "The progress of the age has almost outstripped human belief," Daniel Webster said. "The future is known only to omniscience." The progress of the age, the rapid growth of the population, the unending chain of machines, and the astonishing array of goods combined to produce an unceasing and often uneasy fascination with what lay ahead. What next? Political economists, in particular, busied themselves with working out a system for understanding the relationship between the present and the future. In Paris, a philosopher named Karl Marx began making predictions about the consequences of capitalism. He saw in the increase in the production of goods a decrease in the value of labor and a widening inequality between the rich and the poor. The worker becomes all the poorer the more wealth he produces, Marx argued in 1844. The devaluation of the world of men is in direct proportion to the increasing value of the world of things. American thinkers pondered this problem, too. Emerson wrote, "'Tis the day of the chattel, web to weave and corn to grind. Things are in the saddle, and ride mankind." In the United States, the political debate about the world of people and the world of things contributed to the agonized debate about slavery. Can people be things? Meanwhile, the geographical vastness of the United States meant that the anxiety about the machinery of industrial capitalism took the form not of Marxism, with its argument that the history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggles, but instead of a romance with nature and with the land and with all things rustic. Against the factory, Americans posed not a socialist utopia, but the log cabin. "It did not happen to me to be born in a log cabin," Webster, a three-time presidential aspirant, sighed, despairing of his biographical deficiency in the age of the log cabin presidency. But the most famous log cabin in 19th century America was the one built in 1844 by Emerson's 27-year-old friend, Henry David Thoreau. The year the railroad reached Concord, Thoreau built a log cabin on a patch of land Emerson owned on Walden Pond, a kettle pond a little more than a mile outside of town. He dug a cellar at the site of a woodchuck's burrow. He borrowed an axe and hewed framing timbers out of white pine. "We boast that we belong to the 19th century and are making the most rapid strides of any nation," Thoreau wrote from the 10-by-15-foot cabin he built over that cellar at a cost of $28.12. He used the boards from an old shanty for siding. He mixed his own plaster, firm lime, $2.40, that was high, and horsehair, 31 cents, more than I needed. He moved in fittingly on the 4th of July. The chimney he built before winter from second-hand bricks marked real progress, but he didn't think the same could be said for the nation's rapid strides and vast designs. He had the gravest of doubts about what the machine was doing to the American soul, the American people, and the land itself. The telegraph? We are in great haste to construct a magnetic telegraph from Maine to Texas, but Maine and Texas, it may be, have nothing important to communicate. The postal system? I never received in my life more than one or two letters that were worth the postage. The nation's much-vaunted network of newspapers? We are a race of titmen and soar but little higher in our intellectual flights than the columns of the daily paper. Banks and railroads? Men have an indistinct notion that if they keep up this activity of joint stocks and spades long enough, all will at length ride somewhere, next to no time and for nothing. But though a crowd rushes to the depot and the conductor shouts, "All aboard!" when the smoke is blown away and the vapor condensed, it will be perceived that a few are riding, but the rest are run over. Instead of Marx, America had Thoreau. Thoreau's experiment wasn't a business, it was an anti-business. He paid attention to what things cost, because he tried never to buy anything. Instead, he bartered and lived on 27 cents a week. At his most entrepreneurial, he planted a field of beans and realized a profit of $8.71. "I was determined to know beans," he wrote in a particularly beautiful and elegiac chapter called The Bean Field. He worked for cash only 6 weeks out of the year and spent the rest of his time reading and writing, planting beans and picking huckleberries. "Mr. Thoreau is thus at war with the political economy of the age," one critic complained. Thoreau had chosen not to be ridden by the machine, not to live in this restless, nervous, bustling, trivial 19th century, but to stand or sit thoughtfully while it goes by. One pressing question woke him up every morning, as regularly as the screech of the whistle of the train that chugged by his cabin on tracks built just up the hill from Walden Pond, where he'd hoped to still his soul. Were all these vast designs and rapid strides worth it? Thoreau thought not. He came to this truth. They are but improved means to an unimproved end. And still the trains chugged along, and the factories hummed, and the banks opened and closed, and the presses printed newspapers, and the telegraph wires reached across the nation in one great and unending thrum. Chapter 7 of Ships and Shipwrecks. The day Abel Upshur died, the fate of the Union turned on the question of Texas. On the afternoon of February 28, 1844, Upshur, John Tyler's Secretary of State, boarded the USS Princeton, an iron-hulled, steam-powered warship, for a short trip along the icy waters of the Potomac. Tyler boarded too, and so did all but one member of his cabinet, along with hundreds more dignitaries, soldiers and sailors, and invited guests, and top hats and uniforms, and snugly buttoned gowns wrapped in woolen cloaks. James Madison's aging widow Dolly was there, shivering against the wind, along with John C. Calhoun's young son Patrick, a second lieutenant in the army, and General Juan El Monte, the straight-backed and stalwart Mexican ambassador, his cuffs embroidered with gold, his epaulets like wings. The U.S. Senate was about to vote on a treaty to annex Texas, a long-sought land of ranges and plains, of cattle towns and rushing rivers. Upshur, 53 and balding, with a broad forehead and a long, slender nose, had stayed up late the night before, counting votes and pondering war. Mexico considered Texas one of its provinces, if a rebelling one. If the Senate approved annexation, Upshur knew, Mexico might well declare war on the United States. Upshur, who before he became Secretary of State had been Secretary of the Navy, expected the war to be waged at sea in the Gulf of Mexico, and he had been building up the fleet, preparing for battle. The USS Princeton was the Navy's most formidable warship. The point of setting forth on the Potomac was to offer, to El Monte, a demonstration of the ship's fearsome cannon, the largest gun ever mounted on a battleship. It was called the Peacemaker. As the ship steamed along the river, the gun was fired three times, each with a thundering, earth-shaking roar. Obeying the orders of the ship's doctor, the guests kept their hands over their ears and their mouths wide open to blunt the force of the shockwave. El Monte seemed suitably daunted. There was to be one more display, a salute to George Washington as the great ship steamed past Mount Vernon. Tyler, a gaunt and ungainly man, had staked his presidency on annexation. But his presidency had been weak from the start, and by the time the treaty was drafted, he was a president without a party. A southern aristocrat who despised populism, Tyler had been nominated as Harrison's running mate because he'd been a vocal critic of both Jackson and Van Buren, and because Whigs hoped he would carry his crucial home state, Virginia. He'd hardly been queried on his politics, nor had voters been informed of them. As one campaign song had it, "We will vote for Tyler, therefore, without a why or a wherefore." But Tyler did have political positions, strenuously held. He had long advocated states' rights. An opponent of the National Bank, Tyler didn't like anything national. He once complained about the signs he saw all over Washington, D.C. "National Hotel, National Bootblack, National Blacksmith, National Oyster House." In April 1841, after Harrison died only weeks after his inauguration, Congress had twice passed legislation renewing the charter of the National Bank, and twice Tyler had vetoed it. By September, every member of Tyler's cabinet, except his Secretary of State, Daniel Webster, had resigned in protest. 2 days later, 50 Whig members of Congress gathered on the steps of the Capitol and banished the president from the party. Protesters rallied outside the White House. Fearful for his safety, Tyler had established a presidential police force. It later became the Secret Service. His only respite from the incessant political assault had come during a time of tragedy. His wife, Letitia, suffered a stroke. Having borne 8 children, she died in the White House in September 1842. When Charles Dickens met Tyler while on a headlong tour of the United States that year, the novelist wrote that the president looked somewhat worn and anxious, and well he might, being at war with everybody. Abel Upshur came to be Tyler's Secretary of War after Webster, the last remaining member of Tyler's original cabinet, resigned in May of 1843 to protest the plan to annex Texas. Webster believed that the Republic was already large enough and that any extension would diminish the spirit of the Union. How could a people so different, spread across thousands of miles, even choose a ruler? He wondered, with how much of mutual intelligence and how much of a spirit of conciliation and harmony those who live on the St. Lawrence and the St. John might be expected ordinarily to unite in the choice of a president with the inhabitants of the banks of the Rio Grande del Norte and the Colorado. When Webster's replacement died of a burst appendix, Tyler appointed Upshur. He might have seen something of himself in him. Upshur, like Tyler, was a southern aristocrat, disdainful of the people. "They read but little," he said, "and they do not think at all." Upshur believed that slavery solved the problem.